From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It seems sometimes like every week throws up another bone of contention between the U.S. and China. China's massive trade surplus, intellectual property rights, currency rates, outsourcing, lost jobs, downward pressure on U.S. wages, and then the really scary ones like a tripwire for war over Taiwan. The world isn't getting any bigger, but China's economy and the muscle that goes with it is. As the two countries grow more interdependent, the cost of potential conflict goes up. But the tensions are very real. Few, if any, are taking America's status as the lone superpower for granted in this century. But when giants tangle, things tend to get wrecked. The stakes in getting it right with China could not be higher. This hour, living with China in the 21st century versus warring with China, hot, cold, or otherwise, if it can be done and how it can be done. You can join the conversation tonight. Is there room enough in the 21st century for the appetites and ambitions of both these great countries? Is China bound to clash with the United States over influence, over resources, or is there an underlying compatibility here? Are we on track for finding it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Banning Garrett, Director of Asia Programs at the Atlantic Council of the United States and Adjunct Professor of Political Science at George Washington University. He's been in China dozens of times over two decades as a consultant for the U.S. Defense Department and other government agencies. Banning Garrett, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. I look forward to the discussion.
Also with us from New York is Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Laureate, Professor of Economics at Columbia University and author of Globalization and Its Discontents. He was Chief Economist and Senior Vice President of the World Bank from 1997 to 2000 and Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Clinton. Joseph Stiglitz, wonderful to have you with us tonight as well.
Nice to be here.
We'll be joined later in the hour by former U.S. Ambassador to China, James Lilly. But Banning Garrett, let me turn first to you. We're seeing for some time now, early in the Bush administration certainly, and then very lately in headlines. Here I'm looking at the Atlantic Monthly, current cover. It's Chinese sailors on top of what looks like a submarine, and the big headline is how we would fight China, the next Cold War. China's booming. The U.S. is used to being the big superpower. Does all this fit in the 21st century, or do we have a conflict inevitable here?
I don't think we have an inevitable conflict at all, and I think that I know that Atlantic Monthly article, and what's interesting is that they don't really discuss knowledgeably Chinese intentions or the larger strategic picture. They just talk about what the U.S. Navy's doing to prepare to possible conflict with China. But I think, in short, that in an era of globalization and what I would call strategic interdependence, that there's a kind of a mutual assured destruction, not only in the nuclear realm, as we had with the Soviet Union, but even in the economic realm, should we either side push our differences to the point of some kind of strategic competition or actual conflict.
Great powers have gone to war before at great cost to both sides. Why not this time?
Well, I think you have a very different international environment. I think if you go back even to the Cold War, you had two world economies with very little interconnection between the two compared to today. And you had a kind of zero-sum game going on strategically. One side wanted to dominate over the other. There were rival ideologies, certainly security alliances and blocs, the Warsaw Pact and NATO. And it was sort of doomed to be some kind of one side would dominate and the other side would lose. I don't think you have that with China. China has no ambitions to push an ideology on the world. It's not a rival strategically, I don't think, with the United States. Of course, we have many differences, and we will, just like we have many differences with France and Germany and Japan. So I don't think, for many reasons, that either side actually sees that strategic competition is the long-term outcome of the rise of China. And I think that there's no good benefit, there's no real benefit that would come from moving to confrontation and even more. There are foreseeable gains and huge losses to both sides.
We'll look more at that strategic picture, particularly competition around Asia, East Asia, and the Taiwan tripwire. But Joseph Stiglitz, on the economic front, we're trying to look at this at very high level tonight. What Americans have seen so far is a lot of lending from China to the United States that has helped keep this country afloat. But on the other hand, a sense of huge outflow of jobs to China, a tremendous trade imbalance with China. Is this a relationship that can find an equilibrium in this century that both countries can live with?
Definitely. The basic fact is that it is a, we economists call it a positive sum. We both gain from it. China's become almost the engine of growth for the global economy. It has been enormous positive effect on the global economy, and growth in one part of the world benefits every other part of the world. So I believe that there really are positive complementarities between the two, and you see that in many, many ways. For instance, we almost take for granted the inexpensive Chinese goods, the cloth, the television sets that we get, that has had an enormous effect in improving our standards of living. If it weren't for those goods, our cost of living would be much, much higher.
But flesh that picture out further for us, because many Americans have seen jobs and factories go to China. We see the trade imbalance is just, it's bigger than ever. It's phenomenal in size. The U.S. has borrowed a lot from China, but of course that's kind of a debt and obligation. In practical terms, you're describing a positive complementarities, but to a lot of Americans it looks like piracy of copyrights, jobs lost, trade imbalance, the U.S. with an unclear picture of its own economic future.
Sure. Let me begin with the issue of trade imbalance. Basically, you have to understand that the source of the trade imbalance is U.S. Macroeconomic imbalances. The problem starts here at home. We save very, very little. We're saving now about 1% of our GDP. That means that we have to borrow abroad. Our low savings rate has, of course, been worsened by the huge fiscal deficits of the federal government. The turnaround from a 2% surplus just 4 years ago to close to 4% deficit today. That's a huge turnaround. So those macroeconomic forces are what lead to the trade deficit.
But do you mean that if Americans saved more, that, I don't know, suddenly we'd have plants in South Carolina making pillows and sheets again instead of in Guangdong?
Well, basically what would happen is we would not have our trade deficit. The real question is, let me put it slightly differently. No matter what China does, if China increased its exchange rate, we will have a trade deficit. The trade deficit is a consequence of our macroeconomic policy. It has nothing to do with China. Now,
but paint a picture for how that might come into balance. Let's say there's savings. Let's even imagine the kind of unimaginable that we got our fiscal house in order. What is it that the United States would sell to China or somebody else that would make all this work out?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that trade is not a two-way street, but a three-way street.
Or more.
We buy oil from one country. Saudi Arabia will buy goods from another country. It's not a bilateral two-way street. So if you look at China's overall picture, China, yes, it does export more to the United States than it imports.
To say the least.
But China's overall trade situation is just a little bit in surplus. In some recent years, it's been in deficit.
But we don't have oil to sell them. They're clearly not buying enough of heavy machinery to make up the difference. What is it?
They're buying goods from other countries. They're buying oil from Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
The question of the global trading pattern is that countries sell more to some country and buy more from other countries.
And does that hold true even when you have a country with a billion three or whatever China's population is now with its low wages?
Principle, it holds no matter what. And so China is, as I say, has basically a small trade surplus. Its trade surplus is smaller than other countries like Japan.
Not with the U.S., but overall.
Maybe just to add in one point here. That
Ben and Garrett.
I think if you look at the overall trade deficit of the United States with Asia, you'll see that much of China's so-called surplus with us has really been transferred from other Asian countries. for example, Taiwan. Recently, when I was in Taiwan, they were enjoying the fact that they used to have a big trade surplus with the United States, which was very problematic in their relations with us. And now they move their factories to China. The goods get exported from China. China takes the hit for the trade surplus, and they get the profits. And you'll see the overall pattern that's taking place in Asia, and the very, in some cases, very small value added in China, and the real value added is elsewhere. But the trade deficit goes against China.
Ben and Garrett, if things are so hunky dory, why do you sense this? Why is there this tension in the United States watching the rise of China?
Well, I think some of the tension is coming from not necessarily from the U.S. government, not the people dealing with China. I think a lot of it is the unease about a rising power and all that, but I don't think that our relations with China are that bad. I think if you remember, Colin Powell at one point said that it's the best relations we've had in China in 30 years, and we're cooperating with them on a wide range of issues.
Joe Stiglitz?
Part of the problem is that there is a real weakness in our economy, not fully reflected in our unemployment statistics. Our unemployment is 5.2%. It's not particularly bad, but there are a lot of discouraged workers. There are a lot of people who have joined the disability rolls because they can't get jobs. That has to do with macro mismanagement. That has to do with the Bush administration not really running the macro economy very well.
Of course, even if that's true, macro mismanagement presumably can put nations on a collision course. I want to come back and look more at that. Joseph Stiglitz, we're so glad to have you with us tonight. Ben and Garrett, we have to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about living with China in the 21st century, if it can be done, and how it can be done. What's your sense? Is this planet big enough for superpower China and superpower USA? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about living with China in the 21st century versus warring with China, hot, cold, or otherwise, if it can be done and how it can be done. My guests tonight, Banning Garrett, Director of the Asia Programs at the Atlantic Council of the United States, and from New York joining us, Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Laureate and Professor of Economics at Columbia University, his most recent book, Globalization and Its Discontents. You can join the conversation tonight. Is there room enough in the 21st century for the appetites and ambitions of both these great nations? Is China bound to clash with the U.S. over influence, over resources, over economic clout? Or are these big powers already joined inevitably at the hip? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ben and Garrett, you quote John Mearsheimer in a piece that you wrote recently at the University of Chicago. He's joined us a number of times on the show, saying, what makes a future Chinese threat so worrisome is that it might be far more powerful and dangerous than any of the potential hegemons that the United States confronted during the 20th century. He says, it's hard to see how the U.S. could prevent China from becoming a peer, competitor, or even eventually a more formidable superpower. What about Mearsheimer's concern?
Well, I think Mearsheimer is using a certain paradigm, which they call the realist paradigm, and he simply says as a country gets bigger and stronger rising power, that it will inevitably seek to expand its defense perimeter, it will pursue aggressive policies, even militarily. It will seek to transform the rules of the game internationally to suit its own purposes. And what's interesting is that this argument's been made about China now for about 15 years, and Chinese policy has actually been rather contrary to the predictions of the theory, so it raises questions about the validity of the theory in my mind. In fact, China has not been belligerent towards neighbors, and for the most part, it's solved almost all of its border problems. It has good ties with countries that it didn't in the past. India, they just had a summit that was quite productive. China has reassured the United States that it has no desire to see the U.S. leave militarily from the region. It doesn't oppose our alliances. It sees us as a stabilizing factor. We help prevent some kind of an arms race in the region. China has bought into the international system. In some cases, it supports the international system more than the Bush administration does on international treaties and the whole global international system. No country has benefited more from globalization than the system we built over the last 50, 60 years to support that internationally than China, and they know it. So I think that they don't see the inevitable clash. And I'd add one more point in here. The Chinese, you might say, read the book. They know what happened with Germany and Japan as rising powers who challenged the current hegemons, the current order, sought to expand their influence by military force. There was disastrous wars, and those powers lost. They don't want to repeat that. They're quite aware of what the outcome could be should they pursue those kind of policies. And I think they've made it clear so far that isn't the direction that they're headed.
Joseph Stiglitz, please.
I think they're focused totally on improving the living standards of their people. China is still a poor country. It has an enormous way to go to close the gap in per capita income between it and the United States. It realizes that every dollar that they spend in defense is a dollar that could have been spent in increasing the welfare of their people.
And yet they're spending a lot on defense.
Well, yes, but it is a small amount compared to what we spend in the United States. It's just a minuscule amount. It's what you might call bare defense needs. Their focus is on their economy.
Joseph Stiglitz, if I may ask you, you suggested earlier that the problems economically between the two countries are largely a consequence of macroeconomic policy, really failures, as you describe them, in the United States. That would suggest that harmony between the two countries in some part rests on the U.S. getting its macroeconomic house in order. But what if it doesn't do that, and yet it's a superpower and feels threatened by China? Does that mess up the harmonious 21st century picture that you're painting?
Not really, because eventually reality will intrude. I mean, obviously, there are politicians that want to take advantage to make hay. In the early 80s, when Reagan had his tax cut, and we had very similar kind of picture. The tax cut led to huge trade deficits. It's called the twin deficit problem.
We focused on Japan.
We blamed Japan. It was, again, the same phenomena. We had what we called macro imbalances, and that was the source of the problem. Now, now it's China rather than Japan, and of course Japan is lucky that we're blaming China, but the reality is it is the United States, and we will reality is going to intrude and say, recognize that nothing that China does will change our basic trade imbalance.
Joe Stiglitz, you're the Nobel laureate in economics here, and we're not. I can feel so many Americans struggling to visualize a situation with China, with its cheap labor, with its huge manufacturing capacity, with its high-end, increasingly, engineering design and R&D. Paint a picture for us in which the United States gets its house in order and comes to something of a more balanced trade picture with a rising China on the planet. What might that look like? It's hard to imagine.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think one has to recognize that the entry of China into the global economy is a big deal. It is a change, and it's going to require adjustment. You know, we've talked about the rhetoric of free trade for a long time. Mm. We said to China, become a market economy. And China followed our advice. It became essentially a market economy, and it joined the WTO. It's getting a lot of the benefits that we said would come from becoming a market economy.
Yep.
And joining international trade. But it is going to require some adjustment on the part of the United States.
Does that mean belt tightening? Does it mean diminished standards of living?
No, what it really means is that we will have to focus more on strengthening our investments in science and research and education. The number of engineering graduates coming out of China is becoming a multiple of the United States. We need to do more in this. You know, the modern economy is a scientific economy, and yet we are not training our students for this new modern scientific economy.
And what about resources? Will the United States not find itself in competition with China for oil, just for starters?
Well, there is.
Are we not already?
Well, there is a global marketplace for natural resources, and you know that's the market economy. You're definitely right. When anybody increases their demand, the price goes up. Again, there's a very easy answer. We ought to be focusing on conservation. The rest of the world has been focusing on conservation. We are out of tune with the rest of the world in our use of energy. So again, there's enormous scope for us to conserve on energy because we have done so bad in the past. So there is an easy response because we've been so bad for us to conserve on our energy, and therefore there is really, again, no real competition other than the ordinary competition of the marketplace.
Banning Garrett, let me put it to you. Both of you are sanguine this evening. We'll hear in a moment from former Ambassador Lilly, who's not quite so sanguine. But here we have a Nobel Prize-winning economist, Joe Stiglitz, and he says, kind of along the lines of you, but he's saying this will be fine. All we have to do is remake our macroeconomics, remake our education system, and remake our energy policy, and we won't have conflict, we won't have war. It seems entirely possible that the U.S. will not succeed in doing some of those things. Might we find ourselves on a track to war, even though both of you guys think there's no need for it?
Well, tell me, Tom, what will be gained by a war?
I don't know, but we've got a history.
You have to ask. I mean, I think that it's a fair question of whether or not we can do what we need to be doing ourselves, regardless of China, to keep our country competitive, to focus on the right issues. When we focus on a lot of the things that Congress seems to be interested in, you kind of wonder whether we're losing our way, but I don't blame that on the Chinese. But the alternative is, do we really need to go to war because our economy may be slacking off compared to somebody else?
Then what about
what will we gain? What are we going to do? Take over China? I mean, what's the goal of the war?
Amen. I hear you. I still just wonder about tension. What about the very real tripwire at Taiwan? I'm looking here. Michael O'Hanlon is writing in the Financial Times in London today, and he says the risk of war over Taiwan is real because China is serious about being willing to risk war to prevent Taiwan's independence, because the U.S. is just as serious, Michael O'Hanlon says, about defending Taiwan, and because even though American military power remains far superior to that of China, he says the Chinese do not need equal power to the U.S. to make war over nearby Taiwan. Is that not a potential flashpoint?
I think Taiwan is a serious issue, and I think that clearly that is the one place where you could have a war. The Chinese leadership finds themselves in quite a bind because it's such a, you know, for the point of view of Chinese, and I think probably, you know, pretty close to the vast majority of them, Taiwan is part of China in their minds. And for a Chinese leader to say it could go become totally permanently separate, de jure independent, it just won't fly. That leader will be out of power. And if it were a democracy, I think you would see that happen even faster than you would under the current regime. So I think this is a problem, and it has to be managed, because that is one place where I think very irrational things could happen from the perspective of the larger national interests of China or the United States. We could find ourselves in a conflict, frankly. And I think it is very disturbing and very damaging to the United States and China that our two militaries are preparing for the possibility the political leadership in each country might call on them to fight over Taiwan.
And they are doing that. Banning Garrett, Joseph Stiglitz, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington tonight James Lilly, Ambassador to the People's Republic of China from 1989 to 91, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs, 85-86, served in the CIA in Asia for 25 years before moving to the State Department. He's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Ambassador Lilly, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
We're trying to take a look at, in very large terms, at this century, Ambassador, and I think you've heard just a bit of this, but whether we've got a compatible relationship with China as it continues to explode in economic, military, and every other kind of influence, or we've got problems down the road, how do you see it?
Well, of course we've got problems down the road with China. We always have and always will. But let me just point out two things for our guests. First of all, a lot of blame is put on the United States for this. Poor labor practices, no savings rate, all this sort of thing. Lift up the rug and look at China. Look at what the problems they have. We look like a Sunday school picnic compared to them.
Problems such as?
58,000 violent demonstrations last year, according to their own statistics, 15% up. They have very serious labor problems all across China, disparities of wealth, inefficient state-owned enterprises, people being released from their jobs, people not being paid, peasants turning a violent violent against the local governments for paving over their five farmlands. I'm reminded of the mayor of Shanghai said. He said, every morning, foreigners come in and slobber all over me, telling me how great China is. Mm. Every afternoon, Chinese come in and dump all over me.
Those sound like internal problems to China, like domestic problems. Why do those lead to problems with the United States?
Well, because everybody's saying the fault is the United States. We've heard our people say about this. It seems to me that China has some very serious domestic problems, and this is their number one priority. It's not expansion. It's dealing with their own disparities of wealth, their corruption, their non-performing loans, all these very serious problems they have. And this is their number one priority.
So they have internal problems, so do we. Therefore, we'll be keeping busy at home and won't go head-to-head in conflict.
Well, look, if you look at this so-called Taiwan tripwire, and everybody's whining about this, including Michael O'Hanlon, and I think his article was really quite disturbing because he didn't get it right. He hasn't looked at the trade statistics and the investment between Taiwan and China, which is astronomical.
You mean they're two bound together, can't afford to go to war?
They are interdependent economically. Mm. They are dependent upon each other. It's an enormous driving force. The second thing, which he seems to have missed, is the political rapprochement that's going on at this moment. I'm not saying this is going to be solved. This is the fourth united front. Nevertheless, it's a serious step moving towards some sort of a reconciliation. You've got this enormous economic force pushing them together, and then you've got the beginnings of political reconciliation, and the Americans run around shouting about a war is coming. It seems to me this is a little bit unrealistic. Yes, of course you've got to prepare your military to deal with any sort of military adventurism, but this is deterrent factor. This is defensive. This is not offensive.
So it sounds as though, Ambassador Lilly, you're describing a situation where the United States and China both have big issues to deal with at home, where Taiwan's not as tight a tripwire as people might think. Are you describing a picture in which we can look forward to not an easy relationship, but a manageable, peaceful, mutually beneficial relationship in this century?
We've got very serious problems with China in terms of intellectual property right violations, which is a very large factor. This has got to be taken care of, and it's eating out American profits and American ability to make money. We've also got very serious problems in terms of market access, in terms of other factors. But the factor is that the Chinese are very dependent upon the American market for their exports to sustain their growth in order to sustain their stability. They're very dependent. They do not want to see any kind of a breakdown in the American economy because they're so dependent upon it.
Joe Stieglitz, this sounds again as though the mutual dependence is such that even when there are tensions, as there inevitably will be between great powers, we'll, as you suggest, get through this century one way or another without beating up on each other.
I think that's right. I think that there is this mutual dependence that takes on a number of forms. You know, they have been a major supplier of money to the United States to finance our huge, huge deficits. There is enormous resources in both economies. I don't think we should over-exaggerate the dependence. China is developing more dependence on its own domestic market. It realizes that in the long run it has to develop its huge potential at home, and it has become a focus of its own concern. Hopefully the United States will eventually turn to the issue of being less dependent on borrowing from abroad, stimulating our own savings somehow, and cutting back on our deficits. So we both have resources with which we can deal with our own problems. But right now, there's clearly a high level of interdependence.
Ambassador Lilly, we've just got you for another half minute here. If you looked at where you are most concerned, that this picture of difficulty but overall peace, where it might break down, where's your greatest fear about conflict with China?
My concern is not Taiwan, it's North Korea. This is the most difficult state probably in the world. It's a Stalinist state with a broken-down economy, probably with some kind of weapons of mass destruction.
But doesn't that draw the U.S. and Beijing together, not apart?
We do not have common objectives in North Korea. We have some common objectives we have some differences. The Chinese do not want to see a unified Korea under Seoul allied to the United States with American troops on the Yalu. Mm. This is their nightmare. They would put up with a Stalinist regime, even with nuclear weapons, in that case. On the other hand, they want to see this country off their back. They want to get this country with some kind of economic reform and some kind of control over their sort of lunatic weapons of mass destruction requirements.
So, North Korea this week testing short-range missiles. Ambassador Lilly, we're out of time with that, but we're so grateful to you for being on. James Lilly, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
James Lilly, former ambassador to the People's Republic of China. You can join us tonight, 1-800-423-8255. We'll get to calls right away. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about living with China in the 21st century versus warring with China, hot, cold, or otherwise, if it can be done and how it can be done. We're joined tonight from New York City by Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist, professor of economics at Columbia University, and from Fairfax, Virginia by Banning Garrett, director of Asia programs at the Atlantic Council of the United States. You can join the conversation tonight. Will the U.S. find a way to live with, even thrive with, an ascendant China? And are the U.S. and China already locked into shared interests around trade and finance, security and global stability and growth? Will the shared interests of Beijing and Washington outweigh their points of conflict and competition? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Taro's calling from New York City. Hi, Taro. You're on the air.
Hi. I enjoy your show. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks very much.
I think the big elephant in the room that no one's talking about is the racial aspect of this story. Unfortunately, I think that many white Americans would be far more accepting of a European or some other white country as an equal rather than an Asian country, and I think that's very unfortunate. I think that
do you see evidence of that, Taro, that there's a racial element to the tensions with China? I mean, hasn't the U.S. been sort of acclimated by Japan's great power over the years to the idea that Asians can and do wield great power in the world?
Right, and I think that's true, and I think it's rather threatening. I think if you look back to the experience with Japan, I think that many Americans had a quite violent reaction to Japan's ascendancy. I think if you remember in the 1980s, many Detroit auto workers smashing Japanese cars. I think that
better to beat up on a car than to beat up on a country. I mean, it wasn't World War II all over again.
That's right, but there were Asian Americans who were beat up.
Yeah.
Being one. But I think that kind of exemplifies how I think that there are some white Americans, unfortunately, who would be kind of hesitant about that. Unfortunately, I really hope that that's not the case. But
Terrell, let us pick it up. And thanks for your call, Banning Garrett. What about the cultural aspect of China's power? The even racial aspect of China's power? Do you see the United States reacting? I don't know, more belligerently or with more unease because it's China?
I don't think so. I mean, I understand the listener's question, and I'm sympathetic to it, but I think that there's a huge number of Asian Americans and Chinese Americans who are very well received and accepted and a very vital part of the United States in every way, in science and technology and economy, et cetera. And there's great ties between Americans and Chinese on a person-to-person level. In fact, one of the odd things about it is I think there's a huge affinity between Americans and Chinese that is really not even shared between Americans and Japanese.
An easier cultural relationship. I've certainly seen that.
I think the Chinese are much more individualistic than the Japanese. And that's the irony. The Japanese are in some ways great communists in the way the society functions.
Very broadly speaking.
Yeah, in that sense of being very communal and very much you don't want to stick up and be nonconformist, whereas the Chinese are very individualistic. That's quite ironic when compared to our perception of China being a former communist country. But I think in a bigger sense, I think I'd like to add here, I think it's important to note that if you go back in the 1970s, people thought that the Soviet Union was going to be number one. We got very hysterical about it. Then in the 80s, it was Japan that was going to be number one. My old friend Ezra Vogel wrote the book called Japan is Number One. Now we are here in the 1990s and into the 21st century, and all of a sudden it's going to be China that's number one. And I think that's just way overblown. I think that, as pointed out by Joe and by Jim Lilly, that China has immense internal problems, huge challenge, just think of trying to bring, you know, 1.3 billion people into the 21st century, particularly where they came from just 25 years ago. They're going to be very focused. They are so far behind the United States in per capita income and in so many measures of power, and they're going to be very, very dependent on good relations with us and other globalizing states for the foreseeable future. So I don't think we should start getting too hysterical about China suddenly emerging as this superpower that's going to displace us.
Joe Stiglitz, let me put that to you. It gets into your bailiwick. What about China as number one? I mean, even if, let's say, it's just half the population that becomes very economically active, how high up the ranking ladder does China go here? I think it's already at something like number six in terms of the...
Well, I think what is true is that China will become probably the number two trading country in the world. It is a major change. Remember, we have the G7 meetings, G8 meetings, and China is not even a member of the G8.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, there is a country that has not been in the inner circles of the world, which deserves to be. And that is a change. But in terms of absolute size of their economy, it will not be up to the size of the American economy for decades. Will it
trump Japan's?
At some point, it clearly will, if they continue to grow at the rate of 8-9%. Remember, they have, as you say, 1.3 billion people. So even if their income is much lower than that of the United States or Japan, there are a lot of people, and you multiply whatever their income per capita is by that number of people, and you get a large number. So they will be an economic force, even though they remain a country that is, on a per capita basis, poorer than that of the United States and Japan for decades.
But a big economic force. Allison's calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Allison. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks
Hi.
For taking the call.
Yeah, sure.
You know, Tom, you made a point a while ago that the average American worker sees this continual outsourcing, sees no rise in minimum wage, sees cuts in education, healthcare, all of that. Can any of you paint a picture of how increased interdependence, increased stability in China, you know, the ascendancy of China, will do anything to benefit the American worker other than cheap consumer goods, which is not the only measure of standard of living, and how this period of time in which there still is huge disparity internally in the wealth in China, how this doesn't turn into an ongoing pool of cottage industry labor you know, that directly impacts work patterns in the U.S.
A kind of bottomless pool. Allison, stick with us. Joe Stiglitz, I'm going to come to you with this again. And you hear the reason I keep banging on this is it's so hard for people to visualize or to share the kind of comfort that you feel on your Olympian heights of economics here. Allison, will you hear her question? What do you say?
Sure. Well, first, there are China is buying goods from the United States, Boeing airplanes. There are many things that we sell, but there is true that we buy more from China than we sell. But
vastly more. Yeah.
Many people who are buying goods, selling goods to China.
But the downward pressure on wages, how is that ever taken away?
Let me point out that one of the reasons that China is so successful is not just that it has unskilled labor. It's what China has done has been to bring together unskilled labor with a large number of engineers, technical, high level of technology.
Yeah, but Allison didn't say unskilled. She said low paid.
That they are low paid relative to the United States, and what will happen over time is that there will be upward pressure on wages. Demand for Chinese labor already in places like the coastal provinces is putting upward pressure on wages.
But when you've got 800 million or a billion in the interior of China still not touched by that economy, doesn't that ameliorate that upward pressure?
It will slow it down, but there will be upward pressure. Wages will be going up.
Mm-hmm.
But the answer is, as I said before, it will require some adjustments. And
on whose part?
That,
will mean that the United States will have to be do a better job investing in the quality of our education.
Allison, are you comforted by this picture?
Well, I'm calling from a school district in which, you know, high school biology classes are using textbooks from different publishers printed from a different year because there's not enough money to get textbooks for the whole class. And this is in New York City, so I find it, I mean, I take the point that the macroeconomic situation in the U.S. could stand adjustment. How do you see that? How do you see us shifting our values in time to avert, you know, a situation in which we cannot compete in the technological level?
Allison, we'll pick it up, and thanks for your call. Joe Stiglitz, I'll put that to you as well. It gets you into the realm of politics, but there it is.
You're right. It's squarely into the realm of politics. I think that there are different views on this. There's one party that has been focusing on tax cuts for upper-income Americans and not investing in education and in technology. And, you know, the issue was raised in the last election. Some people obviously thought there were other issues that were more important. I think in the next 4 years, hopefully people will begin to think about the consequences of the decision that was made just a year ago, and maybe realize that maybe that strategy of tax cuts for upper-income Americans is not the best way of meeting the future needs of our country.
Bannon Garrett, our time is short here. The century is young. We're talking about a long way to go, a lot of growth to come in China, major challenges we're hearing tonight for the United States. You are overall optimistic, but where do you see the major crunches coming conceptually in this relationship in the coming decades?
Well, I think there's a lot of strategic mistrust between the two sides, that we get very wary of what China's up to. They're wary of what our intentions are toward them. These are going to be difficult things to overcome, and you mostly overcome those by a process of working together. But I would say, frankly, that if you look at what the real challenges are we face in this century, in my view, there are two sets of challenges. One is the ones that are security challenges to us emanate almost entirely from weak and failing states. You know, if you look where U.S. forces have fought since the end of the Cold War, every single fight that we've been in has been in a failing state. If it's Somalia or it's former Yugoslavia.
And China is not that, at least certainly not now.
Well, not only not that, they face the same challenges. I was in China 3 days after 9/11, and I was told that, you know, the then President Jiang Zemin was watching CNN when the Second World Trade Tower was hit and went down. And his first response was, if the U.S., they're trying to destroy the U.S. economy. If the U.S. economy goes down, we go down. It's not a zero-sum game. It's a win-win or lose-lose game.
Well, there is an image that will stick with us of the Chinese leader watching that along with the rest of the world, the rest of America. With that, we are out of time. Joseph Stiglitz in New York, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Bannon Garrett in Fairfax, Virginia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, an online hitchhiker's guide to the universe. This is On Point. The new movie version of Douglas Adams' science fiction series, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, topped the box office this weekend. The sci-fi comedy is the story of an Earthling, Arthur Dent, rescued by aliens just before the planet is wiped out to make way for a hyperspace freeway. As it happens, his alien rescuer, Ford Perfect, is an intergalactic researcher for a truly remarkable guidebook. And as Dent discovers in the original BBC radio drama, The Hitchhiker's Guide has the answers to, quote, life, the universe, and everything.
What an extraordinary book.
Let's see. E. Earth. There's the page. It doesn't seem to have an entry.
Yes, it does. See, right there at the bottom of the screen.
Oh, yes.
Harmless.
Harmless? Is that all it's got to say? One word, harmless? What the hell's that supposed to mean?
Well, there are 100 billion stars in the galaxy, and no one knew much about the Earth, of course.
Well, I hope you managed to rectify that a little.
Yes, I transmitted a new entry off to the editor. He had to trim it a bit, but it's still an improvement.
What does it say now?
Mostly harmless.
Mostly harmless?
Now, the planet that is mostly harmless has its own version of the Hitchhiker's Guide. It's a website encyclopedia of life, the universe, and everything, written by anyone who wants to contribute. Real life researcher Jim Sangster is one of hundreds who added their thoughts to the H2G2 site online. Here he describes how H2G2 began.
The origins of H2G2 start back in the early 70s when Douglas Adams was lying in a field in Austria, a little bit drunk, and suddenly had the idea of somebody should do the guide to life, the universe and everything, a sort of hitchhiker's guide to the galaxy. His first idea was to turn it into a radio show, and that was hugely successful, and then he turned it into a series of books, then a TV show. And then in the 1990s, he thought, well, the internet's here now, and it's fantastic, and maybe we can get people from all around the world to do a real-life Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Every researcher sets their own targets. You know, some people want to write about a lot of different things at the same time. Some people want to specialise. We've got one guy who lives out in Pennsylvania who's written 100 entries about different parts of Pennsylvania, the history, the golf courses, the influence of the Hershey Company. Other people want to write about where they live, or they want to write about... Like, I love writing about movies, so I tend to write about movies or television or music. I like entertainment. We've got another a young lad who joined us last year from Ohio who didn't really know what he wanted to do, and he's just suddenly started charting the histories of every single American president. We've been making a few suggestions on which ones he can do, but his only guideline is that they have to be dead first, so he can't libel them. We're constantly surprised by the breadth of knowledge and experience that comes through HGG2 every day. Sometimes we might just get a historical entry, you know, about a king or queen or politician. But every now and again, there's one that comes from left field, like how to hypnotise a chicken or what to do if you're swallowed by a whale and how to survive the experience. We've got a beautiful entry written in the first person by a guy who lived out in the South Pole. That's not an experience that most people get to go through, thankfully, because it's quite chilly and there aren't many bus routes going past there. But... you know, that's something that's quite special, we think, and it makes a sort of a unique element of HGG2. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy might be put in the same bracket as Star Trek or Star Wars or Doctor Who in terms of the fact that it's science fiction. But it's a lot more than that because it's got a sense of humour about it. There's a kind of weird philosophy behind the whole idea that it revolves around this quest to find the answer to life, the universe and everything, and then the disappointment of finding out the answer being just 42. And Douglas's comedy is about the fact that life is so strange, there's not really any point in putting labels on it. So we might as well just go out and enjoy it. The philosophy of the website carries that on. We don't want to necessarily get into changing the world massively, you know, all in one day. We change it by degrees, by hopefully educating people about different matters and opening their minds to different experiences that they might not usually find in their day-to-day life.
Jim Sangster is a researcher and editor of H2G2, the online version of Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. For more on the guide, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.